After days of campaigning for the upcoming presidential vote in Iran, candidates now stand toe-to-toe for a face-off. On Saturday, the seven runners attended the first televised debate, which was aired live on national television. Themed with economy, the first debate required the candidates to answer common questions, ranging from monetary policies to domestic production and boosting exports.
In order to boost domestic production, we need to reduce the taxes levied on our producers and in return increase the taxes on unproductive businesses, such as real estate or forex trading.
8 years ago, in the same place, I showed you a 10,000 rial banknote and warned you that if the current trend went on, our national currency would collapse. We need to take a different approach than using people's pockets to solve the government's problems.
We have prepared a package that consists of 213 projects. 51 of them are focused on harnessing inflation and controlling the prices.
When we speak about eliminating poverty, we're not just talking about basic rights, but it's also about entertainment and health policies. I have a comprehensive plan that can tackle these issues.
We need to turn our focus toward a 500 million strong market that exists in the region and not our 80 million strong domestic market. I mean, we need to strengthen our regional diplomacy and open up to the world to attract investment.
The debate started with random questions to each of the candidates, but got raucous after Abdel Nasser Hemmati picked on the other contenders, saying they're running to promote poverty rather than wealth.
Unlike the other candidates, I don't like to resort to lying to attract more votes. None of them is speaking of the distribution of wealth, but increasing poverty. I will pay equal attention to both creating wealth and its fair distribution.
Hemmati's comment was not left unanswered, as Alireza Zakani lashed out at him by reminding him of his poor performance as the head of the Central Bank of Iran, blaming him for the unprecedented devaluation of the national currency, the rial, which is currently traded at 240,000 against the U.S. dollar.
You have dealt an irreparable blow to the national currency, yet you accuse us of spreading poverty. You have already increased poverty during your tenure, while I speak of national production and boosting it. So please stop making accusations.
There are still two debates to go. The second and third debates will take place on Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will investigate the candidates' cultural and political policies.
While the debate offers an opportunity for each of the candidates to try to stand out and make the best impression to voters, it also gives a chance to the public to weigh up all the choices in one go. Yet, it's still too soon to judge about who stands a better chance to win the race, since the rivalry is still on. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemen Nasrallah movement dismissed as baseless an accusation by the U.S., which mentioned the movement as the main cause behind the war in Yemen. Earlier, the U.S. State Department issued a statement accusing the Nasrallah movement of prolonging the conflict and worsening Yemen's humanitarian crisis by attacking Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen.
The accusation of the U.S. State Department against the Ansarullah movement is part of a larger plan to stop Yemen's army advancement towards the city of Marib. Yemenis will not give in to these pressures. The mediator must be neutral, but the U.S. is biased towards the Saudi-led coalition.
Yemen said the USB's major responsibility for the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Yemen as it supports the Saudi blockade on the war-torn country. They called on the international community to prosecute the U.S. for committing war crimes against the women and the children of Yemen.
The U.S. State Department is not in a position to accuse Ansarullah movement because the war in Yemen has been led by the U.S. Therefore, the U.S. is involved in the war and cannot serve as a mediator. We call on the international community to put the U.S. on trial over committing war crimes against Yemeni children and women.
Earlier, the head of the Yemeni negotiating delegation participating in peace talks in Oman said the other parties are haggling over the suffering of millions of Yemenis for military gains, adding that it is the right of all Yemenis to obtain food, medicine and fuel, even under the ongoing war.
Yemenis say the U.S. has no right to blame them as it is one of the parties of the current war on their country. They believe that bargaining over their suffering is a clear violation of the international law.
Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A number of associations of Palestinians from across Italy jointly organized a demonstration in solidarity with the people of Palestine. A large crowd flooded in Rome's iconic San Giovanni Square to hold a rally dubbed Stop the Occupation, Free Palestine, Jerusalem al-Quds is our capital. Protesters held banners and placards reading Stop the War and Sanctions on Israel.
Politicians, trade union members, anti-war campaigners, people from all walks of life have joined the demonstration demanding justice for Palestinians. They are calling on the Italian government to take a firm stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
I think it is a matter of political opportunism. That's why Italy's support to Palestine has been shifting towards positions inconsistent with those held in the past. There is also a lack of commitment on the part of the moderate political forces that used to hold a balanced stance on the conflict. The rise of right-wing parties and their alignment with Netanyahu's government has changed the dynamics entirely.
Unfortunately, we know full well how economic interests play a crucial role in foreign policy. But we have some good news finally. As on June 2nd, the European Trade Union Confederation issued a resolution calling on Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. Also, working movements are shifting towards pro-Palestinian positions.
Protesters also called on EU member states to impose sanctions on Israel to put an end to what they called a flagrant violation of international law taking place in Palestine. Tens of demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine have been held across Italy in recent days. About 2 weeks ago, pro-Palestine groups staged protests at the Rai national broadcaster headquarters and branches in several Italian cities, complaining that the persecution of Palestinians has been sugar-coated in Israel's favor by the public television company. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of British pro-Palestine activists amassed outside a notorious arms manufacturer near Blackburn on Friday, demanding an end to Israeli arms sales. Anger was vented in various ways, including with a funeral procession honoring the recent martyrdom of over 60 children slain in Gaza.
It's a genocide that's occurring before our eyes. Companies like BAE Systems are complicit in what's going on there. They're providing illegal weaponry.
Now they've been exposed, the Zionist regime, because from footage from on the ground, from Gaza, has come out. And people are starting to realize that this is an apartheid, ethnic cleansing, colonialism regime that is operating, and it has to end.
Today, we came here to send a message to the world. What is the mistake of these children? 64 children have been killed, innocent. Some of them were sleeping in the hands of their parents, and they found themselves dead. Why? One, the answer is occupation. In the occupation, everything will be sorted out.
BAE Systems is one of Britain's biggest arms dealers and is known for building weapons used by Middle Eastern regimes to target innocent civilians in conflict zones.
Essentially here to register our protest and say to BAE Systems and to the government that this is simply unacceptable, that weapons manufactured here in Lancashire, here in England, should be used against civilians in Gaza and in Palestine.
This is the second week that local residents have come in good numbers to condemn BAE Systems, and more action is being planned. Major arms firms such as this have been heavily criticized many times in the past. However, it's very rare for protest movements of this size and frequency to engage in such regular and very direct action. Now, these locals are coming out in numbers, hoping to force a change which will inevitably save lives in places like Palestine and elsewhere too. Robert Carter, Blackburn.
With only less than 2 weeks to go before Iran's presidential elections, the seven candidates have expressed their views and plans in conferences, TV programs, and interviews. Some have criticized the current economic policies, while others pledge to make some fundamental reforms if elected. Mohsen Mehralizadeh said he would seek de-escalation between Iran and other countries, noting that the government should not let for some factors to detach the country from the rest of the world. He also pledged to form a cabinet made of experienced people who are able to solve people's problems. Ebrahim Raisi pledged to do his utmost to end the corruption in the country. He also pointed out the issue of unemployment as a major problem young Iranians are struggling with. He vowed to help the youth with their employment and housing problems. Raisi stressed that his first priority would be people's livelihoods and welfare. Alireza Zakani, who is currently serving as a parliament member, said he would seek a comprehensive progress of the country. He also criticized Iran's current foreign policy and stressed that the country's foreign policy should serve the economy, culture, society, politics, and security by taking a broader horizon into consideration. Former central bank governor Abdel Nasser Himmati said he is a reformist and his main agenda is economic reforms. He called on Iranians to support him with their votes. Himmati noted the mass COVID-19 vaccination would be his first plan after winning the race. Another candidate, Amir Hossein Qazizadeh Hashemi, said his main goal is to support the people by reducing household expenses and increasing purchasing power. He also pledged to eliminate economic rent-seeking and lessen the government's interference in the process of production, imports, and distribution of goods. Former top nuclear negotiator Saeed Jalili called for a strategy in which people can observe and monitor the performance of the government. However, he called on Iranian people not to wait for anyone and continue their efforts towards the development of the country, regardless of who is going to win the presidential race. Mohsen Rezaei criticized former and current administrations for adopting wrong economic policies. Rezaei said such measures have caused economic hardships Iranians have been dealing with for years. The 66-year-old hopeful also called for unity among Iranians in order to be able to overcome the economic crisis.
Squalid accommodation that was not fit to house human beings fleeing persecution. That was how lawyers representing six asylum seekers described Napier Military Barracks in Kent in a case brought to the British High Court. In a landmark ruling, Mr. Justice Lyndon agreed and said all of them were
vulnerable victims of trafficking and or torture who experienced a deterioration in their mental health as a result of their accommodation at Napier Barracks.
Napier Barracks has turned into a resident site for vulnerable asylum seekers despite a warning from Public Health England that the dormitories were not suitable accommodation during a pandemic. However, the court found that this advice was not followed, leading to a COVID outbreak infecting half the residents.
The Home Office responded to the ruling with this statement.
Throughout this period, our accommodation providers and subcontractors have made improvements to the site and continue to do so. It is disappointing that this judgment was reached on the basis of the site prior to the significant improvement works which have taken place in difficult circumstances. Napier will continue to operate and provide safe and secure accommodation. We will carefully consider the ruling and our next steps.
Human rights campaigner Adam Yassir came to the UK as a refugee from Darfur in Sudan. He's been supporting asylum seekers who've been staying at Napier Barracks and gave a witness testimony to the High Court.
Multiple asylum seekers asked me to provide a noise cancellation earplugs, and I asked, and they say, the guys say to me, some people scream at night, they've got PTSD.
Calls are mounting for the Home Office to shut down the controversial barracks after a damning court ruling found that they had acted unlawfully and irrationally, which could potentially lead to damages against the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel.
They felt they need to, they've been used to send message to other asylum seekers, people who are trying to seek safety and security in the UK. But it is the wrong way. It is breaking the law to make a point. It's not the right way, and it isn't working at all. It isn't working. Hence, someone needs to be accountable, and the Home Secretary should actually consider her position.
The ruling by the High Court will be a vindication for lawyers, rights groups, and activists alike, who for too long have had their concerns regarding Napier Barracks ignored. But they will still feel their fight is far from over, while asylum seekers still remain housed there in what the court described as appalling conditions. Ahmed Cabello, London.
In a year not short of drama, the British royal family is embroiled in yet another scandal, claims of historical racism.
Unearthing documents in the UK National Archives, The Guardian has revealed palace officials ban, quote, colored immigrants or foreigners from serving in clerical roles in the royal household until at least the late 1960s. Instead, they were permitted to work as domestic servants.
In the optics of what the royal family has been about, I mean, just a knowledge of history would tell you that it's a highly racialized institution. And regardless of the fact that the Queen runs a Commonwealth, which is a majority of minority ethnic background vis-a-vis the Brits, that would be black and so on, it doesn't surprise me at all.
The ban was eventually ended, but Buckingham Palace has refused to say when, only that its records show employment of ethnic minorities started in the 1990s and that it did not keep records on staff members' race from the decades prior. The archive documents also reveal Queen Elizabeth II has been exempt from race and gender equality laws since their introduction in the kingdom in the 1970s, prohibiting individuals working for her household from suing on discrimination grounds. That exception remains in place to this day.
What is happening is that across the world, people are taking a different view of the royal family. And as she is in charge of the Commonwealth, it does not bode well for the future of the Commonwealth at all.
The new findings come on the heels of allegations earlier this year of racism within the ranks of the royal family from two of its members.
And also concerns and conversations about how dark his skin might be when he's born.
And of silence and denials from other members.
Very much not a racist family.
This week, the Queen will be marking a huge annual spectacle celebrating decades of her reign. Will the new revelations put a damper on the British monarch's so-called platinum jubilee? Saeed Purizab, London.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The
annual report vastly understates civilians killed by the U.S. military, and condolence payments are not offered even in confirmed cases, says Nick Terse, reporter, in an article published under the heading, Pentagon undercounts civilian casualties in new report, experts say. Stay tuned for more. The U.S. military killed 23 civilians and injured another 10 in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Somalia during 2020, according to a Pentagon report on civilian casualties that was released recently and immediately faced charges of being a whitewash. Experts said the report vastly undercounts the dead and wounded from U.S. military operations, and they noted that the Pentagon failed to provide condolence payments even in the handful of cases where it acknowledges causing death or injuries. The failure to accurately account and make amends for civilian harm does a disservice to civilians already suffering unimaginable loss, as well as to the Americans who deserve fuller transparency into the ways that U.S. operations have harmed civilians. Annie Shill, the senior advisor for U.S. policy and advocacy at the Center for Civilians in Conflict, toward The Intercept. She also notes, an enormous discrepancy between DOD civilian casualty numbers and those published by civilian harm tracking organizations, human rights groups, the United Nations, and the media. Conservative accounting of civilians killed by the U.S. military in 2020, according to Air Wars, a UK-based airstrike monitoring group, is almost five times higher. 102 non-combatant deaths resulting from U.S. attacks in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. And, as Chris Woods, the director of Air Wars, pointed out, the Pentagon's failure to pay out any compensation to affected civilians during 2020, despite several million dollars being available for that purpose, suggests a lack of interest in the devastating aftermath of those U.S. actions which go wrong. The Pentagon's dramatic undercount does not include any of the secret attacks carried out by the Central Intelligence Agency, which the U.S. government does not acknowledge. Nor does it take into account the civilian toll resulting from assistance to allies such as Saudi Arabia, whose bombing campaign has killed thousands of civilians in Yemen. The new report also notes that the Defense Department did not offer or make any such ex gratia payments during 2020. The reasons behind the lack of payments and whether any are pending remain opaque. Michael Howard, a Defense Department spokesperson, told The Intercept that numerous factors can affect a commander decision to offer an ex gratia payment, and details on the number of payments planned or in progress are not available on short notice. Experts were vexed by the failure to provide payments. Congress has repeatedly authorized funding for ex gratia payments for civilian harm, and confoundingly, the DOD has repeatedly failed to make substantial use of those funds despite the large number of cases where the department has confirmed civilian casualties, said Civic Shill. This latest annual report covers U.S. military actions in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, as well as Nigeria, where a hostage rescue mission was conducted in 2020. It also adds to the Pentagon's official toll, an additional 63 civilian deaths and 22 injuries during 2017 to 2019, mostly in Iraq and Syria. the Pentagon, Howard noted, continues to assess new reports concerning past operations after they are received and reconsiders previous assessments if new relevant information comes to light. Rather than deploying its sizable resources to conduct comprehensive investigations, experts said that the Pentagon appears to be outsourcing the legwork to human rights groups and journalists, and then only deeming a few cases credible. It appears many of the civilian casualties acknowledged in the report come from outside groups or sources asking the military to review its strikes or actions. Priyanka Mutapati of Columbia Law School's Human Rights Institute told The Intercept, adding, "We just don't see the signs that there is a serious effort to understand the full impact of U.S. military operations on civilians." The Pentagon report marks only the third time the U.S. has acknowledged killing or wounding civilians in Yemen. Last May, the Pentagon stated that it did not identify any civilian casualties resulting from U.S. military operations in Yemen in 2019, but the new Defense Department report now acknowledges the killing of one civilian in Al Baitha, Yemen, on January 22, 2019. An investigation by the Yemen-based Mutuana for Human Rights, published earlier this year, revealed that an airstrike in Al Baitha on January 21 or 22, 2019, killed Saleh Ahmad Muhammad Al Ghaisi, a 67-year-old farmer and painter who locals said had no terrorist affiliations. A witness told Mutuana that a drone conducted an airstrike on Saleh's car. "We are being killed in cold blood," said family members. The U.S. military has spent nearly 20 years killing people in Yemen, but still hasn't worked out how to properly investigate and ensure accountability, said Raila Mutawakkil, the chairperson of Mutuana for Human Rights, adding, "This new belated admission by the U.S. military shows how inadequate initial U.S. assessments of its own operations are. Its records cannot be trusted." Over 4 years, the Trump administration conducted at least 181 attacks in Yemen, nearly the same total as President Barack Obama carried out during 8 years in office. Attacks under Trump resulted in an estimated 76 to 154 civilians' death, according to Air Wars. The Defense Department, however, claims that as few as 13 civilians may have been killed or two wounded in three attacks during that same four-year span. U.S. Central Commander CENTCOM only acknowledged the January 2019 civilian death about 5 months after Mutuana presented evidence that Saleh Ahmad Muhammad Al-Ghaisi was a non-combatant. It's become a pattern. The Pentagon's previous Yemeni civilian casualty admissions, both stemming from attacks in 2017 under Trump, followed reporting by The Intercept of a massacre of Yemenis by Navy SEALs and an air wars investigation of an air strike that the Pentagon later said wounded two civilians. There is no evidence of CENTCOM ever having reported civilian harm from its actions in Yemen, unless first prompted by media or NGOs. That suggests, in our view, a lack of command prioritization on this vital issue, Wood said. Air Wars was shocked to learn, for example, that despite reported civilian harm having escalated sharply in Yemen under Donald Trump, no permanent civilian casualty assessment team was created to review such claims. Mutuana reported that Saleh Ahmad Muhammad Al-Ghaisi was his family's primary breadwinner, and his car, on which his relatives relied, cost thousands of dollars. Other families have also experienced financial hardship in the wake of attacks where the U.S. has admitted civilian casualties, but offered no ex-gratia payments despite funds being available in the Pentagon's budget. It is astonishing that the U.S. military has acknowledged new reports of civilian death, but has not made a single payment to an affected civilian, or, as far as we know, any offer of assistance, said Mota Party of Human Rights Institute, adding, acknowledging errors is an important step, but those harmed are left to rebuild their lives and recover from losses with nothing.
The debate.
The discovery of remains of 215 children, some as young as three, at a former residential school in Canada, has reopened wounds among the Indigenous survivors of colonial Canadian schools. Yet, when it comes to condemning Canada, condemnations were very far and in between. In this edition of The Debate, we will look at the depth of this problem in Canada and why the Indigenous community and First Nation people continue to be discriminated and traumatized even to this day.
The last month's discovery of the remains of 215 children at a former Catholic school for Indigenous students in Canada has reopened old wounds and fueled outrage in the country about the lack of information and accountability regarding violations of Indigenous people's rights. On the weekend, thousands of Canadians took to the streets in Toronto to call for greater action from the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on the country's infamous residential school system.
What they need to do is acknowledge that this was a wrong. What Trudeau doesn't want to acknowledge that it was a genocide. But there's actually been five genocides, the fifth one ongoing.
Demonstrators also tore down the statue of Egerton Ryerson, one of the architects of the residential school system at a Toronto university named after him. Following the discovery of the mass grave at a site of Kamloops Indian Residential School in British Columbia, Trudeau said it was a painful reminder of a shameful chapter in Canada's history and urged the Catholic Church to take responsibility for its role in such schools. Pope Francis expressed his pain over the discovery, but stopped short of offering a direct apology.
I follow with pain the news coming from Canada about the shocking discovery of the remains of 215 children, pupils of the Kamloops Indian Residential School in the province of British Columbia. I join the Canadian bishops and the entire Catholic Church in Canada in expressing my closeness to the Canadian people traumatized by the shocking news. The sad discovery further raises awareness of the pains and sufferings of the past.
Indigenous leaders and school survivors, however, dismissed the Pope's expression of pain, saying the Church needs to do much more. Between the 1870s and 1990s, more than 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend boarding schools which were run by churches and aimed to forcibly assimilate Indigenous children into the white Canadian society. The children were separated from their families and barred from speaking Indigenous languages while experienced physical, psychological, and sexual abuse, among other forms of mistreatment. More than 4,000 Indigenous children are known to have died at Canada's residential schools, but efforts continue to find others who never returned home. In 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada concluded that a country committed, quote, cultural genocide with its decades-long residential school system. Besides, reports suggest thousands of Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or gone missing in the country over the past 30 years. Canada has touted itself as the first country in the world to adopt a multiculturalism policy. It has also depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights. Nonetheless, the discovery of the bodies at a former boarding school and lack of meaningful action on the issue of missing women and girls have raised serious questions about such claims.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, joins us from Ontario. We also have lawyer and academic Jonathan Levy joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Edward Corrigan, let me first start with you. I mean, we did cover what happened in this tragic incident, but why don't you give us a quick wrap-up as to what actually occurred?
Well, there was a deliberate policy to assimilate the natives' children. They felt that the adult indigenous people were not, couldn't be changed, but if they take the children, and the quote was to kill the Indian and the child. So children were ordered and taken from their families and forced to go to these schools. As many as 150,000 children were there, 138 schools, and the conditions were horrific. They were, they were cold, they were not proper ventilation. They would put children who were sick with tuberculosis in with the other children, so that at one school, I read that 69% of the children died, and they estimate that around 25% of the children who attended the schools did die, but they don't have proper record keeping. The 215 children's bodies that were found in Kamloops, it's just the tip of the iceberg. There's other schools where they found 15 bodies, and I think if they were to examine, the other schools, 138 schools, they would also find bodies there. They're buried in unmarked graves. They're not properly looked after. The families, in many cases, are not notified of the death of their children. It was just silence. And this is, government policy, government funding, run by the churches, and they were trying to, force them to convert to Christianity. They punished them if they spoke the native language. They didn't have to speak English or French. And it really was like a penal colony. And you have, horrific treatment. And, of course, it didn't work. The native children didn't have the skills to compete, yet they were also torn away from their own societies and cultures and couldn't even maybe communicate with their parents because they knew English or French, but the parents did not. They only spoke indigenous language. So it is horrific how these natives were treated. And it was based upon sort of the aggressive assimilation policy that was employed in the United States by General Ulysses Grant. But yeah, this is a really dark, terrible history, chapter in Canada's history.
It really is, and I'm looking down at some of the things that confirms some of the statements that you made there. And Jonathan Levy, I'd like to find out from you, why were they targeted in such a form and manner? Why, for example, would the church or the residential school system forcibly separate these First Nation children from their families? But in essence, why were they being targeted?
Well, as Mr. Corrigan pointed out, there was a genocidal policy behind it. But in addition, there was already a policy in Canada of contracting with the Catholic Church to provide social services, and the provinces made money. They were paid money by the federal government. In the case of Quebec, 100,000 children went through orphanages and institutions. Some were First Nations people, and some were just simply from disadvantaged families. And the Catholic Church used them for medical experimentation, administered electroshock because they would be paid more money if the children were labeled psychiatric cases. And this went on for 20, 30 years in Quebec. And we're still trying to locate, the mass graves from there. We know where some of them are. The group is called the Duplessis Orphans. And that's a subset of the larger problem in Canada and the terrible problem with the Catholic Church providing social services and everybody making money from it. It was not just genocide, but a corrupt financial bargain between some of the provincial governments and the Catholic Church.
Okay. Again, I'm trying to get to the origins of how this all came about. So you have these First Nation children, and then you have the church, which is supposed to obviously spell religion, come and take them away from their parents and commit some of the most brutal acts that both you both of our guests here have talked about, Jonathan Levy, you mentioned it, and Edward Corrigan, you also, it doesn't quite make sense as to why a church would do that, why they would do experiments on these children to go to that extreme. And it comes back to my question as to why they were being targeted in this form and manner. Edward Corrigan, can you expand a little bit more for us on that?
Well, it's basically racism. And the English settlers and the French settlers that came here thought that their society was superior to the natives. And the churches thought the same, and they wanted to take the children away from their indigenous beliefs, which were considered pagan, and turn them into Christians. And this was done, you know, in horrific ways through punishment. If the parents didn't release the children, they weren't able to get baby bonuses. And during this period, actually, Indians had no right to vote. If they got, you know, professional skills, they were removed, taken away from, you know, Indian status. They were, these experiments on food. There's a whole pile of different experiments where they would keep a test group and keep them, you know, malnourished, then try to have another group of children that would have different, you know, higher and better food. But it was, you know, it said, you look at these, it looks like terrible prison conditions of the worst kind. And, you know, the children were all packed in together. And so if one child had tuberculosis or any other diseases, it would spread to all the other children. So, you know, very high numbers of diseases affected the kids. And of course, many children died because they had inadequate food, inadequate health care, inadequate ventilation. And everything about this was a disaster. And the more numbers they had, the more money they got. But there was not enough money to look after the children properly. And, you know, the federal government provided some money, the province, you know, the province has control over education, but not with regard to the Indians. They were considered wards of the federal government, but they never were properly looked after. So you have these, you know, horrific memories being dragged back because of the discovery of the 215 graves. But there's, you know, probably, you know, 6,000 or more graves like this, and many people, they don't know who is buried there. And there's this, you know, these children just sort of disappeared. People ran away from the schools because they're so horrific, and they were punished severely if that happened. But the families weren't told, in many cases, you know, if their child died, and they were sent away from populated areas to try to minimize the contact between the families and the children in this sort of aggressive assimilation project to turn, you know, the natives into, you know, good little, you know, English-speaking citizens or French-speaking citizens. And, you know, they were, you know, up until, as you know, 1996 was the last school that closed, which is not that long ago. So this period, and, you know, there were periodic reports, and the Truth and Reconciliation report is very, very important. And it, you know, termed that what was treated, how the Indian children were treated and the natives were treated was cultural genocide. So I agree with that. But, you know, this is over, you know, barely 25 years ago, and there was no punishment. You know, they're unmarked graves, and they build over stuff. And, you know, it's when they were putting in a water line, and they uncovered 15 bodies at one school. So there are many, many schools, and people estimate that perhaps as many 25% of the children who attended these schools ended up dying, you know, primarily of disease. But there was sexual abuse, physical abuse, and, you know, social and psychological abuse was all part and parcel of this attempt to assimilate the Indians and natives of indigenous people.
Okay, so we have expanded on that as much as we can. So we have an idea about the horrific experiences that these kids had. But could the possibility, Jonathan Levy, be that this is all about land? We know that Canada asserted control over indigenous people and lands. It was just in 1985 when indigenous people were viewed as citizens. So this is very recent. And I'm just trying to connect the dots here. If it's related in any sense that they are taking the kids away because these lands would eventually be transferred to the kids. But without the kids, then you have the adults that they have to deal with, which at some point they're going to pass away. Of course, then you have restrictions, you have discrimination exercised against them. Is that an outlook or a way to look at this situation?
Sadly, in Canada, there's been a lot of institutional abuse, and finances have also been, you know, the motivation. So, yeah, if you're committing genocide against a people, the idea is you are going to try to diminish them and perhaps take their land, which has always been a problem with the First Nations people. And of course, the entire institutional system with orphans in Canada was based on making money from the federal government. So there was a very strong profit motive involved. And, you know, the people involved should be punished both financially and morally for what they've done. Because, again, some of it was indeed trying to perhaps change the Indians into something they were not. But really, when you look at it, it was genocide. And the idea of genocide is to extinguish people.
Well, what about the Canadian government here, Edward Corrigan? I'm looking at the figure over here that government had, I guess, committed to back in 2019. We can go and check that stat out. At $28.1 million was just allocated. Was $33.8 million was allocated for this. But out of that figure, $27.1 million has yet to be spent. Why is the Canadian president, who in his speeches does talk about the Indigenous people and how they're being victimized, but not doing really much about it, as he's been criticized for?
Well, there was a $1.9 billion compensation fund that was set up by the federal government to compensate, you know, Indian Native children who were in the residential school system. They got $10,000 for if they were there for a year or part of a year, and then $3,000 for each additional year. But they had to sign a release that there would not be any other claim of compensation against the government or the churches. They did have some exemptions for, you know, sexual abuse and severe physical abuse, but this was a way of trying to, you know, hide the real extent of the problem and give, you know, what is probably fairly limited compensation for the treatment that these, you know, children received. Now, the Catholic Church has not formally apologized for its treatment. The Anglican Church, the United Church, and the Presbyterian Church have, in fact, apologized. But the Catholic Church was the largest provider of these schools, you know, in Quebec, across Canada. There's, you know, set over 138 of these schools. And you have, you know, it was sort of a sick system. People were sick. They were put to school, even if they were dying. And of course, if they have a disease that's contagious, it immediately gets spread to the other students that are in these, you know, close confined quarters. And it's, you know, it is really sad when you're reading about these reports. It just, you can't believe how bad it was. And there were some people who did try to solve the problem, and there was some talk of even getting rid of the reserve system. The reserve system in Canada actually is kind of like a system of apartheid, where the Indians keep on land. And the South African government at one point came up to study the reserve system in Canada to use it as a model for their own system of apartheid in South Africa. And I think that's a shocking revelation. If you think most Canadians would not say, oh, we never had apartheid, we're good, you know, we treat people properly. But unfortunately, it's the opposite of the case. There was really brutal treatment of these children. And, you know, cultural genocide, you know, bordering on, you know, physical genocide. And the orphans were taken away from the children, or even if they had parents, and were put up for adoption. You know, there's 20-plus thousand people were put through the orphan system. And, you know, it's a really sad, sad chapter of Canada's history. Now, hopefully, the federal government will, you know, take responsibility and also put the money in so that they can identify who, in fact, is buried in these unmarked graves and provide some sort of compensation and closure for the families.
Well, right now, the Canadian Prime Minister is actually, Jonathan Levy, criticizing the Catholic Church, aside from what our guest, Eric Corrigan, says about the closure, that responsibility being in the hands of the government. The church is supposed to come out, is supposed to take some responsibility here based on what the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has said. And there's been a lot of critique leveled against the Pope that he has not come out with apology really on this, and for the for that institution to take responsibility. Why do you think that is?
Clearly duplicity involved here between both Trudeau and the Pope. The Canadian government can hold the Catholic Church through their various orders in Canada responsible if it had the will to do so. So what you're seeing here is the Canadian government can blame the church doesn't apologize, the Canadian government says, well, we can't resolve this because the church isn't cooperating. The church knows where the graves are, where the grave sites are, and they're working behind the scenes, hand in glove, both of them trying to avoid greater liability. The Canadian government has done a settlement with some of the native peoples, but there is a similar problem with non-native peoples who were forced into orphanages run by the church for the profit motive. So that's why it's a duplicitous game between Trudeau and the Pope. The Pope is sort of, they're bouncing it off each other, neither one wanting to take responsibility. And indeed, the Catholic Church has escaped liability almost altogether in these matters. And they own vast tracts of land. They have the resources to make a settlement. And they're not accountable to anyone, even though Trudeau could hold them accountable if he wanted to.
Okay, in less than a minute, Edward Corrigan, discrimination against Indigenous people still happens. Is it being addressed properly, or is there a lack of this issue being addressed within Canada? Under a minute.
It's not being addressed properly because you still have, much higher incarceration rates for the Native population. And you have alcoholism, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, a whole pile of psychiatric disorders, which stem from actually the residential school system, plus racism against our Indigenous population. I think one of the reasons why the Catholic Church doesn't want to give a formal apology is that because of legal liability, if they're admitting that they're responsible, that would be a strong base upon which to launch lawsuits against the Catholic Church and other churches. So the church is concerned about that. They want to limit their legal liability, but I think they should really take responsibility for this horrific period in the treatment of our Indigenous people.
Indeed. Thank you so much. We're going to end with the international human rights lawyer, Edward Corrigan. Thank you for your comments, and lawyer and academic Jonathan Levy there from London. That brings us to an end for this edition of The Debate. So thanks for tuning in. Until next time, I've been Kavitha Wei.